online at near.ie and on air across northeast Dublin. 90.3, this is Near FM.
Malcolm X said, "If you stick a knife 9 inches into my back and pull it out 3 inches, that is not progress. Even if you pull it out all the way, that is not progress. Progress is healing the wound, and America hasn't even begun to pull out the knife." Good afternoon, you're welcome to International Politics Near 90.3 FM's look at the world of international politics and national politics of international significance. I'm Peter Carney and I'm with you fortnightly every Tuesday from around 3.30 to 4.30pm. Well, not from around, exactly 3.30 to 4.30pm. And on this day, the 2nd of July, significant political happenings. In 1823, Bahia Independence Day, the end of Portuguese rule in Brazil. 1871, Victor Emmanuel II of Italy enters Rome after having conquered it. And in 1934, the Night of the Long Knives ends with the death of Ernst Röhm. So all of that on the 2nd of July. Significant political births on this date. Well, the only one I could find was in 1942, the ex-Mexican president Vicente Fox born on this day. So on this fortnight show in international politics, we have a lot lined up for you as usual. The three countries, I suppose, we're dealing with are Poland / Israel. We're looking going to the UK and then it's back again to Ireland. So in Poland, Israel, a speaker, Uri Orlev, was in town a week and a half ago, a survivor of Bergen-Belsen. I caught up with him to talk about his experiences there as well as some other matters. The UK, I'm speaking this week, or I've already spoken, it's a recorded interview with Tommy Robinson, who is, as you probably know, head of the English Defence League, the notorious English Defence League. And back in Ireland, I'm speaking to people from Justice Watch Ireland. They have their first annual conference in Belfast the weekend before last, so a little bit more from them later on in the show. So, as usual, if you want to participate, you can do so by texting us on 087-6944-500. That's 087-6944-500. You can call the station directly on 01867-1190. That's 01867-1190. Or if you want to contact me, you can do so directly on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. Just put in International Politics Dublin or Twitter, put in Peter's Politics and you'll find me right there. Okay, so on to our first guest of the fortnight, and as I said, is with Uri Orlev, who is a Bergen-Belsen Holocaust survivor. He's also an author. Born in Warsaw in 1931, he escaped from the Warsaw ghetto but was sent to Bergen-Belsen in 1943, after which he emigrated to Israel. As I said, he was in Dublin about a week and a half ago, talking in the European Parliament or European Council building, as well as talking at the Dalkey, I think it was the Dalkey Book Fair as well he was at. So I decided to meet up with him to talk to him about his experiences in Bergen-Belsen. Now, in the interview I'm playing now, occasionally you will hear his wife intervene with assisting with the translation from Hebrew into English, even though his English is actually quite good. In the interview, I ask him about what it was like in Bergen-Belsen, how he ended up there. He tells us about this thing called Hotel Polski, which was used by the Nazis to lure the Jewish people out of the non-Jewish parts of Warsaw. I ask him as well about his attitudes towards the non-Jewish Polish people at the time, as well as similarities of any that he sees between the wall that the Nazis built around the ghetto in Warsaw and the wall that currently stands around the West Bank in Palestine today. So this is my interview with a Holocaust survivor and Bergen-Belsen survivor, Mr. Uri Orlev. So I'll get straight to the point and I'll ask you, what were conditions like at Bergen-Belsen?
It's a long story. Maybe you can open Google and look for Hotel Polski. Hotel, you know what it is? Polski, yeah. Polski.
Yeah.
Polish.
Yeah.
But the name of the hotel is Polski.
Uh-huh.
It was after the revolt of the Jews in the ghetto also. Mm. And it was already burned everything. And for the German, Warsaw was Judenfrei. And then they got the Gestapo in Warsaw, they got a Vakasha.
A request?
From Berlin, from the Gestapo in Berlin.
Request.
If they can find Jews, they are on a list. Because they looked for Ausländers. You know German?
Yeah, foreigners, yes.
So they looked for Ausländers. And because they want to change them, I don't know, for the German in Palestine or maybe another German, Uruguay, Paraguay, the South American countries. And also a short list of 260 people, a list of Palestine. And they ask the Gestapo in Warsaw to find if they can find these people. All these people were already dead, of course. The Gestapo in Warsaw asked the what I call the Jewish Gestapo.
Right, the collaborators.
Yeah.
Collaborators.
And they told them, we are open a hotel.
Okay.
And if they are some Jewish people in Warsaw, hiding, tell them that we are not going to catch them and we are taking them to Ausländer camp.
Okay.
And we will
exchange them for Germans, who were kept captives, yes, in other countries. Like, for example, you had in Palestine Templars from the, you know, old German...
from the Knights Templar.
Yes. And they were German citizens
the
time
British
before.
Put them in a camp.
And the British kept them, that was the British mandate in Palestine at the time. It was before. So they wanted to exchange them for these, the Jews for the German mega deal.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And of course, this was just yet another
and
lie.
Suddenly, a few
appeared.
Families, Jewish families, with children and people, more and more, and came to this hotel.
Yeah.
The people that came, they lost their hiding places.
Okay.
And they didn't have a choice to think about. But maybe some of them really decided to do it. Because the Jewish Gestapo, let's say, they took these papers for themselves and for their families. So it was a good sign for another Jewish people. The Jewish collaborators, they sold these papers. For a lot of, they have a list which Jews are rich from before the war. And they took a lot of money to sell these Uruguay-Paraguay papers. So it was a paper, promessa, let's say, for Mr. Ruja, and empty page for his family. So what did Mr. Ruja? He paid all the money and then he sold the empty page to another people.
And as if they are his family, you see?
And did they use this to get their own people out, or was it just a profit-making scheme they were at?
I believe they wanted to rescue as many people as they can.
Okay.
But you know, when it's life, so if somebody has money and somebody doesn't have any money and doesn't have any food, so we can ask, tell him, you pay me money, I can buy food or get some food, so I'll give you the place here as if you are my family.
So this is essentially what Hotel Polski was about.
Yeah.
It was to draw the Jewish people out of hiding, and then obviously they were sent on to concentration camps from there.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that was the end. But
yeah,
at the beginning it was very promising. Because it was a deal.
And we came in the evening to a small station in Bergen. It was in the evening, it was dark already. And came trucks, and came German soldiers and German officers. It was after the ghetto revolt, yes? You understand what I'm talking? That all the Jews were already killed by the Germans. And they helped the Jews to go up on the trucks, to go down from the train. They helped them to take the
luggage.
It was something you cannot believe. You couldn't believe there. And they brought us to a camp of green barracks. And when we opened our eyes in the morning, it was like paradise. Many families with children. We can play. We were in the cellar for 2 months or 3 months. Forest around. And it was sent.
It was sent.
And the people brought many food in the valises.
In their suitcases.
Suitcases.
People had, in food they brought with them.
And they threw the German food. It saved our life, Bergen-Belsen. You see? In this point. There was a school that the people did the school for children. There was two camps, women and men. But at night, the men went to the women and they make hilulot. The end was that came Zeidel, a high officer of Gestapo. I think they didn't need any more these Jews. And we stayed there 2 years, and it was not anymore a paradise. Mm-hmm. It became Bergen-Belsen, what you know about. Bergen-Belsen, it was not only one camp. It was many camps, each camp different terms. Terms?
Yeah.
There was working camps, there was...
Yeah, there were camps where they had these Muslims. You know what's this? Muslims were the people who were so...
Already dead.
Half
they
dead,
still
like skeletons, walking skeletons. And they had a special camp for those who were hardly... Because they were so hungry and so tortured and so...
And they are killing them. They didn't put them in the... There was no gas chamber in Bergen-Belsen.
Mm.
So they are killing them by couple, killing, it doesn't matter.
Mm.
And we stay, and the conditions become worse and worse. Less food.
Good. Now, this place that you called Hotel Polski, how long did that charade go on for?
Till the first transport left.
Right,
just
and
for
that was
a very short time.
Okay.
And then another Jews came there, and they didn't succeed.
Mm.
They stay in Beit Sohar,
Machanot. They took them to jail. They took them to concentration camps.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting episode in the war.
Yeah. And how did you feel, or what was your knowledge of the non-Jewish community in Warsaw at the time? How did they respond?
You see, in Warsaw there was 1 million people and 3,100 were Jews.
Before wartime.
Before the war. Mm-hmm. So you can understand, if a merchant, socher, mitchare itcha,
merchant is competing you,
Let money, less money that you take.
Mm.
And the alekuchot lokhim olchim elav.
And the clients go to him,
If he's Polish, Christian like you, you cannot say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But if he is Jew, it's the hatred for Jews.
Hatred.
Because you are not Poland, you are not Polish, it's not your country. Go away to Palestine.
And this was the attitude of the non-Jewish people in Warsaw?
Not all of them.
Not all of them.
But many of them.
Mm-hmm.
There was also people that helped the Jews.
Mm.
And it was not easy to help Jews.
The wall was built around the ghetto in Warsaw. Do you see any similarities between the wall around the ghetto in Warsaw and the wall that is in place in the West Bank, in Palestine, in Israel?
Of course not.
No.
You see, it was not a war between German and Jews.
Mm-hmm.
In the war, you have terrible things happen from both sides. the German Jews in the First World War, they were in the German army. Mm-hmm. They were pilots, they were officers, they were on the ships. Suddenly it was not a war. Uh-huh. It was something else. You cannot compare it. Mm-hmm. Here we have a war, long war, between the Israelis and the Palestinians for a very small land.
And thank you very much, Mr. Uriel Lev, for his time in that interview on the Israeli embassy also. Okay, on to our next event. Founded in 2009 as a reaction to the demonstration organised by Al-Majiran against the war in Afghanistan as the Royal Anglian Regiment marched through the town after a tour of duty in the Helmand province, the EDL, the English Defence League, was founded. It's headed, as you know, by Tommy Robinson. Now, having seen a number of his debates and interviews on TV, and what they stand for, what they purport to stand for, many of the TV debates and the contributors in the TV debates said that Tommy Robinson was a racist, and they branded him a racist, and he didn't really have much of an opportunity to respond. So I decided then to catch up with him to find out a little bit more about him. Now, as you'll hear in the interview, I concluded anyway that he's not a racist, he has decided, and the EDL have decided, to focus on the negative and the extreme actions of some Muslims, and then decided to deem that all Muslims, and indeed the religion, or as he says, is not a religion, the ideology of Islam is completely like that and something that needs to be opposed. He seems to conclude that Islam is fine provided it behaves a little bit more like Christianity, which is kind of a strange stance to take. Anyway, it's his stance, so I thought, fair enough, give him a chance to say what he has to say on the show. So here it is. This is Tommy Robinson from the EDL. Tommy Robinson from the EDL, can you tell us what the English Defence League stands for?
We formed in support of our armed forces. We're fed up of watching an inability by our government to tackle Islamist extremism. There is also a two-tier policing system and a two-tier funding system. One where we treat a non-Muslim community with iron fists and the Muslim community with kid gloves. It's as though we do have a master race in this country, and that has to end, and we will stand against it. And what we've been doing for 4 years now is highlighting different problems that come from the Islamist ideology and from the deep-rooted hate within the Quran. And whether it be terrorism, female genital mutilation, or Muslim grooming gangs, there's a vast range of problems that are coming, and we've been highlighting them for 4 years.
Okay. Now, Tommy, would you not accept that those things that you've highlighted, in particular grooming, that there's no evidence of any of that in the Quran at all? So
Yes, there is. Actually, within the Quran, it says 14 times that Muslims can take non-Muslim women as sexual slaves. It clearly states that outside of their four wives, they can take anything that their right arm possesses, which is non-Muslim sexual slaves. The Prophet Muhammad was 56 years old when he married a six-year-old child called Aisha, and he was 59 years old, so he was 89, when he consummated that marriage. And that, in modern term Britain, that's paedophilia. Now, Muslims who accept the Sharia within their ideology, accept that it's okay to have sex with a child once they start their periods. Whether they be 10 years old, 9 years old, 11 years old, they're fair game. Now, that is an ideology that's inbred within them. Now, Muslims see our country as al-Dharab, which is house of war. Certain Muslims, not all Muslims, but a percentage of them do. Now, when at war, Muhammad clearly states to them in the Quran, they can take non-Muslim sexual slaves. Now, that's what these men are doing. What we have to look at is the common denominator amongst all of these crimes and all the criminals doing it. And the fact that 85% of these people arrested for this grooming and convicted are Muslim men. We only have 5% of this country is Muslim. So why are 85% of the people convicted for it Muslim? We have to search for the reason why. Not just brush it under the carpet and pretend it, because you won't solve the problem. By saying like that, it's not Islamic, it's not Muslims. No, it is. This is an Islamic problem.
So you're not just against Islamic extremists, you're against the whole religion of Islam.
I'm against the Islamist ideology. I'm against Islam taking in a 7th century form. If you take that to the word, the extreme word of the Quran, yeah, I'm against it. Because it promotes hate and intolerance towards non-Muslims. I'm against that. Of course I'm against it. I stand for freedom. I stand for human rights. And the Quran doesn't. Islam doesn't. So we've already had the European Court of Human Rights, and that, not with all aspects of Sharia law, due to their view on homosexuals, their view on women, and their view on non-Muslims. So this is something that's already been outlawed.
Well, the view on homosexuals is not peculiar to Islam. That also exists in Judaism, it exists in Christianity.
There's a difference between promoting and saying that it's wrong and saying that they should be executed. There's a big difference.
Right.
You're
focusing on a number of different points that you've discovered about Islam and the Quran. Now, you're also ignoring certain other points as well, such as the giving of alms, the fasting at the time of Ramadan, how they support other members of the community.
The fasting at the time of Ramadan actually cost our country in excess of hundreds of millions of pounds due to diabetes. The percentage of diabetes in the Islamic is rocketing. They're having to set up special NHS centres within their community to deal with it due to their bad and diet and not eating for 16 hours during daylight. And the whole concept of Ramadan is flawed as well, because if Allah created this entire world, if he didn't want you to eat when it's daylight, then what about in Russia, where it's daylight 24 hours a day, 7 days a week? What's the point in it? Because you'd be dead. So you'd die if you're not allowed to eat or drink. So, okay, we respect other people's faiths and what they want to do, but when it's costing our government and our taxpayers hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds every year, the life expectancy of a Muslim in Britain is 59. It's very below average because of these sorts of health issues which come from that, as well as marrying their first cousins. There's many things that come from these problems. Now, all we're doing is pointing them out and saying that this is not right, which is not. Now, in the year 2013, we should not be encouraging 50% of the Muslims of Bradford to marry their first cousins and give high rates of disability. We should be enacting, we should be saying it's wrong, saying that we should evolve with time. But that's the problem we've got, is I'm not evolved at all.
Right, when you say they're not evolved, then you're not accepting their faith. I mean, you've pointed out the negative aspects of their faith. There's a whole lot of positive aspects of their faith.
Charity, the way they are with their family. There are many positives. And, of course, there are certain sections of the Ahmadiyya sect of Islam are completely peaceful. They have reformed their religion. There is no hate. They do tremendous work for even armed forces, which is why I do, when I give my speeches, whilst I am a strong critic of Islam, I've gone out my way to point out that I'm not against Muslims, because there are some amazing Muslims.
So the
Islam that we see spreading in our country, as you will see in Ireland, you'll see Wahhabi and Salafi sects, which is funded by Saudi Arabia. Now, this is extreme. They're extreme sects.
Right.
And to be honest, they're not going to bring any good to this country.
Okay, so...
So we're going to tackle them and really...
Yeah, so the base of what you're saying, Tommy, but the base of what you're saying is, as long as they behave in a fashion that's acceptable to you and in a good, quote-unquote, good Christian fashion, then it's acceptable. But then that's not allowing them to profess their faith. I mean, you're using terms like liberalism and democracy and so forth, but really it's an abuse of those terms, because you don't really accept them for who they are.
What we accept is that I don't see Islam as a religion. It's an ideology. Similar to Nazism and Islamism, the political wing of Islam, it's not just about praying, is it? It's got taxes, it's got law, it's got inheritance. It's a complete way of life. Now, that's not just me. The Italian government have come out and said the same, that they don't recognise it as a religion. So when we're talking about these religious freedoms and these religious rights, they should be exempt to religions. But if I found Scientology and I criticise Scientology, no one's going to want to kill me, and no one's going to call me a racist. I actually put some fear for my life after wear a bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
I've had four official ordnance warnings from the British government, which have told me I have to leave my hometown. I have to go into hiding because they want to kill me. We've had terrorists in prison recently for 20 years for planning to blow us up and murder us. Now, we have to look at why they wanted to blow us up and murder us. It's because of the scripture in the Quran that tells them that they must kill anyone who criticises the Prophet Muhammad. Now, the Prophet, I don't want to insult all Muslims, but the Prophet Muhammad needs criticising. He was not like Jesus. He was not a peaceful man. He was far from it. He participated in murder, in rape, in genocide. Then this is not a religion of peace. I've done my studying, I've done my reading, I've done my research, and it's not peaceful. It never has been peaceful, in fact, for 1,400 years.
Yeah. Well, I know a number of Muslims, and I know a number of Muslims who follow the Quran very closely, and they're very peaceful people. Now, in relation to the violence and aggression you've highlighted, there's a tremendous amount of violence and aggression against Muslims from Christian countries, from the United States, from Britain, in Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever you care to mention it. Muslims are under attack in Burma, in Sri Lanka. There's a tremendous amount of violence aimed at Muslim countries. There's attacks on Muslim countries. So is it not normal to expect that they will respond with violence?
I'm against the war. First off, I think it's an illegal war. I think Tony Blair should be tried for war crimes. I'm completely against Afghanistan and Iraq, and I completely understand that when Muslims say how angry they are, that many Muslim, innocent Muslims are dying. Yes, they are. But our forces swear allegiance to Queen. They don't, and the elected government choose the war that they go into. And they're out there trying to broker peace or taking down dictators. Now, it's a lose-lose situation, because at present, all the Muslims are crying out and begging us to go into Syria. In the same way they were crying out and begging us to go into Iraq and take out Saddam Hussein. But when they do, they're all going to be moaning when there's civil disorder across the whole country. And what you have to look at, the most Muslims in these countries, in Iraq, Afghanistan, all these countries, are blown up and murdered by each other because of Shia Sunni factions. Last week, there's 225 killed in Iraq from bombs outside mosques.
Yeah, there's
that's
a difference.
The British forces.
Okay, no, there's a difference. There's a difference between begging and pleading with somebody to come in and help you to remove a dictator, and then once that dictator is gone, surely you would imagine that those people should leave and leave the country back to the people who it belongs to, and not to rape them off their resources. There's a big difference.
You're speaking to the converted on that issue. I believe we are in their country for their resources. I believe that the government have chose that. I believe that our politicians are greedy, still wanting people.
So is their anger not understandable then?
And I understand, but at the same time, when you look at, say, for example, Catholics in Nigeria, not this Christmas, last Christmas, on Christmas Day, five Catholic churches were blown to pieces by Boko Haram. Now, that doesn't... I feel that. I'm a Catholic. I feel that when I hear that, yeah? And my family feels it. And I feel for those Christians that's happened to. That doesn't make me want to go out and start beheading or planting bombs on Muslims.
Okay, Tommy, just to speak to you about the EDL itself... It's been said that the members of the EDL have threatened Guardian journalists. The Guardian did a documentary itself where some of the members of the EDL were caught on video shouting racist chants in the video itself. How do you respond to that?
Well, basically, that video was 3 years ago. We've gone a long way since 3 years. If you're asking me, are there racists in the EDL, I'm not going to lie to you. Of course there are.
Right.
Like, there's racists in the Metropolitan Police Force. It doesn't make it a racist police force. We've got golfers in the EDL. It also doesn't make it a golf society.
Right.
Like, there are racists in the EDL, and when we find them, we drive them out.
Okay.
I've had one of my convictions is for in this last 4 years, is for knocking someone out at a demonstration who's given a Nazi salute.
Right.
I hate Nazis.
Okay.
I hate racists. I'm from one of the most multicultural towns in Europe.
Okay, all right.
My best mates are black, you know what I mean? My mother's Irish. My mum was an Irish immigrant too.
Okay, all right. Also, the EDLSF, you don't keep a membership list. Why is that?
We have no membership list. It's just a voice and people join on the street. So I'll tell you what it is, mate. I'm a working class lad. I was just 4 years ago going about working on a building site, living my life. And then this happened, which was when our soldiers were attacked. And I wanted to make a stand, and I haven't been groomed for this or educated in a way to be involved in politics. I've just took it on.
Okay, and just one last one for you, Tommy. Recently, Pamela Geller was refused entry to the UK to speak at one of your rallies. What do you think of that, and why would you invite somebody like that who's been very openly, verbally aggressive herself towards Muslims?
That's a bit aggressive, actually. She's a very well-respected lady in America. She fights for freedom again. Now, if being overly aggressive is telling the truth about Islam, William Gladstone, our previous leader of this country, he said there will never be peace on this earth so long as we have the Quran. It's a violent and a cursed book. Sir Winston Churchill, he said Islam and a man is like rabies and a dog.
Great. Well, thanks very much to Tommy and his time for that in the EDL. But of course, the number of points that he mentions is like other people who bring up negativity and extremism in Islam. They seem to forget that, Christians carry out extreme acts around the world, not to mention of many number of things, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, bombing of abortion clinics and whatnot. Yet nobody seems to label that as Christian extremism or think badly of Christians because of it. Another thing that's closely associated with Islam is stoning. Part of Sharia law, yet if you read the Quran, I haven't read the Quran, but from experts I've spoken to, tell me that there is no mention of stoning whatsoever in the Quran. And in fact, if you were to read the Bible, there's 39 mentions of stoning in the Bible. So make your own mind up. Okay, so after the break, we're going to be talking to the people at Justice Watch Ireland of a brief interview with Gareth Pearce, the famous human rights lawyer Gareth Pearce. And I think it's time now for the promos.
Community radio for North East Dublin, 90.3. Near FM.
Marty was dead to begin with. There's no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker and the chief mourner.
Reaching from behind him, Akira felt for an orchid that he had laid upon the ground. Finding it, he placed it in his hands and rolled it vigorously between his palms until
the egg yolks gradually beating all the time. Stir in some almonds and whisk the egg whites until stiff.
Listen to Cover every second Friday from 3:30 to 4:30 here on Near FM.
For a great buffet of tastes and trivia, tune in to Lunchtime with Saturday. Every weekday from 1 to 2 p.m. So for the eclectic and the electric, tune into Lunchtime with Sammy. So don't your ears deserve it.
Do you know what? Our mates have made a brand new programme called Story.
It's 5 weekly programmes targeting a different topic each week that are on drugs, alcohol, bullying, role models, youth in the community and relationships.
Our mates are a bit mad in the head, so tune in this Wednesday and listen up.
It's starting 12th of June, 6 p.m. for 5 weeks.
So hear our story on Near FM.
Shoreheads,
rockers,
hippies and
goths.
We lived those teenage years
with the music of the Grove.
Every Friday from 10 to the end with me, Peter Gaynor,
and me, Lynn Kavanagh,
on The Grove Show
here on Near FM.
Are these songs slow down just a little bit?
Text 087 69 44 500.
90.3 Near FM.
Welcome back to International Politics, into the final part of the show. And as I was saying earlier on, I was up in Belfast the weekend before last at the first annual conference of Justice Watch Ireland. Justice Watch Ireland are dedicated to protecting human rights and the civil liberties of all the people throughout Ireland. It's a cross-community body, Protestants, Catholics and everybody. Held its first annual conference, as I said, in Belfast a week and a half ago, or the weekend before last. In its inaugural conference, there were justice campaigners such as the well-known human rights lawyer Gareth Pearce, Jerry Conlon from the Guildford Four, Paddy Hill from the Birmingham Six, John Finucane, son of the murdered human rights solicitor Pat Finucane, of which there is allegations of collusion between British terrorists and the British government. There was also speakers there from the PUP, the Progressive Unionist Party, Mr Ken Wilkinson, people from Airigi, Republican Sinn Féin. Now, among the campaigns that they're leading, the justice campaigns that they're leading are Justice for the Craigavon 2 and for Stephen Murney. A little bit more about that later on. But first up, I caught up with Gareth Pearce to talk to her about how she got involved with Justice Watch Ireland and the work that she carries out.
Things better or worse now since you first got involved?
Every time you think there's been a change and a victory or an improvement, what you realise you're endlessly naive in thinking is that's the end of it. And then at the drop of a hat or a perceived crisis or a neurosis on the part of the state, you suddenly wake up to the fact that the goalposts have been moved and the state's acquired new powers, new ways of dealing with the individual who it dislikes or is suspect in some way. And so the answer is, yes, things change, but they don't necessarily improve or resolve themselves.
Okay. Was there something in particular that, or was there anything in particular, probably nothing, that attracted you to human rights abuses against Irish people or the Islamic community?
I don't think the words attract. there was a suspect community under attack from the British state for decades in the north of Ireland and in England. There is you could say, globally in England, a new suspect community now, the Muslim community. However, we're pretty adept at creating suspect communities when it suits the miners for the duration of the miners' strike, or student protesters if they come out in the streets. And you observe how the individual can be unjustly accused or treated, but that if you step back and look at the bigger picture, you see that this is state policy and more than a one by one. There's an overarching theme to it.
Can I ask you maybe about the reaction of your colleagues in the legal profession when you first got involved in this, defending people who were accused of bombing Britain and so forth? Did you, was it largely supportive, or did you meet much opposition?
The answer is I'm not sure. There's a lot goes unspoken. Yeah. And maybe there was opposition, maybe there was, but I'm probably too unobservant to notice.
You see the court system, or even the whole legal system, in some ways as a way of authorities using it as a way to maybe delay the work of people that they would see as opponents. I mean, is it a tactic? Is there a genuine concern on their behalf, or is it used as a tactic to delay people who they may see as opponents?
I think the courts are not necessarily always visible in this process. One of the extraordinary aspects of the liberation of Libya is that mountains of documents have been revealed from offices in what was previously Gaddafi's Tripoli, which show the interchange of between intelligence services, between our intelligence services and those of dictatorships such as Gaddafi. And you see explicitly, overtly in the documentation, conducting policies of harassment or worse, jointly involved in pressuring of families, rendering people to Gaddafi's torture chambers to obtain information, but explicitly is the term create a hostile environment. That's what you see in relation to the UK, our security services, create a hostile environment. And that, one can observe, is exactly what's done in a variety of ways, when it suits.
Right. What would those variety of ways be? Or an example of those?
It's pretty easy to make life intolerable without arresting people. Irish people had the experience for decades, if they travelled to England, of knowing they would be stopped, they might not catch their plane, they would be questioned. Mothers with children would be told, well, we could keep you here a long time and then your children would be taken into care. Precisely what's happening now with Muslims travelling, the fear of what's being done ostensibly perfectly within the law, short of an accusation that takes you to court, but nevertheless you don't live your life with normality but in fear.
And in terms of yourself and the authorities, have they ever tried to delay you or make your life difficult for the work that you do?
Who knows? Again, I'm probably too unobservant to notice. If I miss a flight, it's probably because I'm late.
I come from a very, very heavy British military family. My father served 30 years in the British Army. and I'm very proud of it. When I got out of prison, I promised the people in jail in 1991, other innocent people, that I would spend the first 12 months of my life campaigning for them. That's what I intended to do. I only intended to campaign for 12 months. But unfortunately, after I got out, I got involved with the families. And it's because of the families that I'm still doing today what I started 21 years ago. I never realized what my family went through until I met other families that were going through the same thing. And of course, when you go into prison, your families and yourself become very, very detached and very estranged because you're sitting there telling each other lies. Well, my family used to come and visit me in prison, used to ask me how I was doing. I used to say, oh, don't worry, everything's great. How in the name of God can anything be great when you're serving 21 life sentences for nothing? And of course, we've been very, very fortunate. In our organisation, we are non-sectarian, we are non-political, and we are non, no matter what religion you belong to or anything else, what your background is, we don't care. We only have one criteria in the Miscarriage of Justice organisation, and that is that you are innocent. And if we investigate a case and if we believe that you are not innocent, we get rid of you immediately and we tell you why. We are right up front with everyone. We are very fortunate in the fact that over the last 20 years we have built up a great rapport with not only solicitors, but also with pathologists, with people in the forensic world, who are a hell of a lot of work to help us. When we get cases, we don't just jump into bed with people because they say they're innocent. The first thing we ask them to do is to provide us with all the paperwork that they have and to give us authorisation to get all the paperwork from their solicitors and anyone else who represents them. And then we investigate the case. About 70% of the support that we have in Glasgow comes from Ranger supporters, and I'm very, very proud of that. We have managed to cross the divide in Scotland, and one of the things that we have to do here today is to make sure that once again we cross that divide. Injustices, human rights, it's not about Catholic human rights, it's not about Protestant human rights, it's about everyone's human rights. We should all stand together, because what they take away from one, they will end up taking away from all of us.
I name every policeman who tortured me, without fear. I name the politicians who were involved and conspiring to put me in jail, and put my father in jail, and put my cousins in jail. Patrick McGuire, 13 years of age, his dream was to grow up and be in the parachute regiment, to follow his father into the British Army. If you'd have went into Ellie McGuire's house, and I wonder at times what the police who went into Ellie McGuire's house must have thought when they were greeted by a large photograph of the Queen Mother, a bust of Winston Churchill, and a Union Jack on the wall. Did they not stop for 1 minute and think? Anyway, we went on trial with a young English girl, Carol Richardson, 16 years of age. They were doing it to their own. They were doing it to their own. In my head, I had sort of come to terms with it a little bit because I'd lived here. But I couldn't believe what was happening to me over there. We ended up getting sentenced on the 22nd. Of October 1975. And when we were being sentenced, the judge, John Donaldson, said, I'm disappointed and I want to know why. The proper sentence is no longer on the statute book. Hang, because I would execute the four of us. He would have hung us. The Balcombe Street people who committed the Guildford and Woolwich bombings were arrested on Thursday, the 16th of December 1975. And at the end of the siege, they were taken to four individual police stations and they were left overnight. And at the same time, the next day, four different sets of special branch and bomb squad officers went in to interview them. And when asked what was the first bombing they had done, they said you put innocent people in jail. And they made long, detailed statements about it. How they'd done it, the type of explosives, what they'd put in it, everything, and they give details of the people who were in the boat. They were charged 9 months later after they contacted Frank McGuire, an independent MP, who went to see him in Wandsworth prison, who came out and said that these people admitted their crime that other people are in jail for. The British police took them out and took them to a special court and charged them with Guildford and Woolwich. And 3 weeks before their trial, they took them to another special court and dropped the charges and put in 8 complex conspiracy charges, which they were found not guilty of. And they used our trial as a platform to prove our innocence. And on that basis, we were granted an appeal. And in September 77, we went to the appeal court and we sat there for a month and we listened to all the evidence. And I remember vividly Joe Connell giving evidence and Michael Hooper stopping him in mid-flow, saying you don't have to respond. And they accepted their evidence. A month later, at the end of October, they came back and they gave their judgment. And Roscoe, who was the presiding judge, along with Lawton and Board, said, we accept that the 4 people in the document, become known as the Guildford 4, didn't bomb Guildford. In all likelihood, they've never been to Guildford. And in the case of Helen Armstrong, we accept that they didn't bomb Woolwich. But we think it's possible they may have known the people who did it, although we have no evidence to show that they were connected. And he sent us back to jail for about 12 years. Oh, 12 years, my dad died. And I knew at some stage I was going to get out because I shouldn't have been there. Now, the Prevention of Terrorism Act was brought in for a specific thing, to deal with the IRA. Within 5 years, it had seeped down into mainstream policing and was now being used against the unions. Margaret Thatcher used it against the coal miners. So things that they introduce as a security measure designed for one specific thing has a habit of seeping in. Somehow we knew we were going to get our names cleared. And who helped us? Was it the Irish? Was it the Irish government? Was it the Irish press? Was it Irish documentary companies? No, it wasn't. It wasn't. They did nothing. They did absolutely nothing. They didn't come and see us in jail until British TV documentary companies had made documentaries about us, World in Action, First Tuesday, Panorama, the Times had written letters about us. Because they acquiesced. They acquiesced, and I'll tell you a story. When my dad died in 1980, on Wednesday the 23rd of January, Gareth Fitzgerald had just been elected. And there was uproar at the Birmingham Sixes appeal being put, knocked back, and my dad died. And he got hold of the head of the forensic department, Professor Donovan, and he called him in, he gave him £1.5 million Irish pounds to investigate the forensic that sent innocent people to jail. And a year later he came back and he threw the report on the table that said my dad was innocent, the McGuire's were innocent, the Birmingham Six was innocent. What did Gareth Fitzgerald do? He threw it in the bin. He threw the report in the bin. We had got a congressman called Hamilton Fish, who was a Republican congressman, who was given $500,000 grant from the American government to investigate the forensics in relation to the McGuire 7 and the Birmingham 6. And Sean Donovan, the first secretary at the Washington Embassy, went to Hamilton Fish and says, stay away from this. We've had it from the horse's mouth. We've had it from the IRA and the Irish government. They're up to their necks in it.
There was a breakup of marriages. There was a loss of jobs. And the PSNI, these are stories that don't come out. There was one young man who the police thralled in England. That young lad originally came from Glengormley. He committed suicide. Them's the facts that don't come out. Was seen a pathetic figure brought forward by the PPS, a man who was a heroin addict, ended up an envoy, who was trolled by the RUC, the PSNI, the special branch, for the Gibb Athens. A real, real sorry sight. But to say, what I'm here to talk about is the human side of it. The effects, the knock-on effects that it has within my community. And to whose aim and whose game would it be, the Supergrass trials and where they're coming from? Who would want to take out of our society the people who have delivered the peace process, the people who helped deliver the Good Friday Agreement, and the people who helped deliver decommissioning, the people who took the step at a time when it wasn't the thing to do. We were demonised, victimised within our own communities, that we were traitors, that we were sellout merchants. But still withal, the last Supergrass trial, we had two brothers, the Stuart brothers. And from day one, people knew what they were. These were people who were drug addicts, alcoholics, had robbed of their own mother and father, and stole £2,500 and went on a spree to England, and then decided to come back and give evidence against 13 people. Is that justice? But what was seen was a sham, was a mockery that took place within that courthouse. But the suffering of the families, the people who didn't see their families. And then there was another case within that, a man called Rob Warnick. God rest him. Him and his wife were also mentioned in part of that. And Rob had a letter from Mo Mullen stating that the good work that he had done during the peace process. Rob's wife had cancer, and Rob went to the hospital with her, and Rob was diagnosed with cancer as well. They had booked a holiday with their friends. Two friends wanted to go on a holiday, and I sat in on the appeal with them, and they were turned down. A year later, Rob Warnick and his wife are dead with cancer. So them's the human side of things. We also have had other cases that are coming out of the HEP. I have sat on many cases with people at the HEP. One in particular, I'm not mentioning the name. And they come out, the paperwork and reach of the lady. There you are. I says, that's not acceptable. We're not accepting that. We want six booklets, and we want to go to them. You can back us a month. And the discrepancies that we found within that report left a lot to be desired.
Well, basically, I get involved with the Craig Alvin 2 group to start off with, and out of that, spreaded the idea for Justice Watch Ireland. The last year, I found myself 9 months basically interned by remand, which is happening to a lot of people who politically oppose the current status quo in the north of Ireland. Unfortunately, my political position found me in McGilvery Jail. I was accused of possession of explosives with intent to endanger life. But when it came to the point where they had to produce evidence in court to substantiate these claims, I was released after 9 months. I lost my job. You know, I found myself in a difficult position with my family and whatever. So I found myself back out in the state now, and you feel that you have to get involved. I became friendly with John Paul Wooten and Bram McConville in McGilvery Jail, and I seen their case and I seen how ridiculous it was. And everyone was shocked at that time that both men were convicted. But if you looked at it from the mainstream media perspective, it looked like a slam dunk case. But when you scratch under the surface and actually look at the facts of the case, you see how ridiculous and how wide open it is there. You know, and if that's the burden of proof that two men go to jail for life, you know, anybody could be open to that sort of case. So people like, we reached out and we got people like Jerry and others involved. All we ask,
Jerry Conlon.
Yeah, Jerry Conlon and that involved. What we ask people is, we're not saying believe us, we're saying look at the facts. Here's the facts. We have the facts compiled. And all we say is, look at the facts. This case stinks to high heaven. So in the back of that, you've heard yourself from other campaign groups there, including not just within republicanism but also within loyalism, that there is something fundamentally wrong with the justice system in the north of Ireland. And on the back of that, we're hoping to find Justice Watch Ireland as a charity.
Great and stuff like that. So, John Finucane, can you tell me why you got involved with Justice Watch Ireland?
Well, I was asked to speak here today by Jerry Conlon. I've worked with Jerry on the Justice for the Craig Alvin 2 campaign. I represent John Paul Wooten, who has been convicted along with Brendan McConville of the murder of Constable Stephen Carroll in 2009. There are a number of serious concerns around the legitimacy of that conviction, and Jerry Conlon has involved himself in that campaign. So when he asked me to speak at the launch of his organisation today, I was delighted to do so.
Right, great. And can you just tell us, for the benefit of the listeners, a bit about that campaign and the review into the killing, the murder of your father, Pat Finucane?
Yes, In December 2012, the Prime Minister, David Cameron, announced in the House of Commons, following a review by Desmond De Silva, that indeed the government accepted that there was collusion in the murder of my father, and he apologised to my family for doing so. And what he was apologising for was the actions, the very deliberate actions and policies of the security establishment of the British state, namely the police, the army and the security services, in the fact that they targeted, facilitated the murder and covered up following that. Now, it was very much a review that we felt was flawed, in the sense that it was a secretive review and it stopped short of pointing the finger at any political responsibility. Because of that, because of the nature of the fact that it was non-statutory, that it had no powers to summon witnesses, and it was very much a review carried out behind closed doors, we continue to campaign for a full public inquiry, and indeed we are in the process and in the middle of a legal challenge to the British government in relation to that.
Right, so that's what that stands at the moment, is a legal challenge to it. And where do you see that panning out? Where do you see it going?
Well, there have been a number of interesting points that have come out in respect of disclosure, in respect of our challenge to the British government. It made some headlines at the start of the year in respect of comments by people within the British government that the case of Pat Finucane represented things that were worse than had come out of Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think that gives a flavour of certainly how the British government viewed this. As I say, we will continue to campaign until we get a full public inquiry, because this is not just, and for some time it has not just been about the murder of my father. I think it represents and will have an impact on many other families who lost loved ones.
Fantastic, thank you very much.
I was invited to speak here for the event by Just Watch Ireland, by Gerry Conlon, who has become a friend of mine over the years, particularly because of our interaction through our mutual lawyer, Gareth Pearce, who had told me many years ago, in 98, that it was first the Irish and then it would now be the Muslim community. And, of course, she was making reference to Gerry Conlon, what had happened to the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four. My involvement today is really to try to understand some of the links and the parallels that exist between the former criminalised communities here and the present criminalised community in England. The look at laws that are being passed that affect us here and in the United Kingdom, like the Justice and Security Act, which seeks to introduce secret courts whereby people can be imprisoned and held, or their cases, which in my in particular, can be heard in secret, which suggests there have been involvement of the security services in complicity in torture. And a sense of solidarity to tell the people over here that it's really important that whoever's been subjected to abuses by the security services must record, must document, and must present through the legal process and elsewhere to the community what's happening to them, because the silence by one of us affects us all.
And thank you very much to the final speaker there, Muazzam Beg, who was a detainee, an ex-detainee in Guantanamo Bay. Thank you very much to him and for his time. More information on that group and its work is at justicewatchireland.com, and you can get information on the cases that they're taking on about the Craig Gavin 2 and Stephen Murney. So that's about it for me, Peter Carney, for this fortnight. I'm back in a fortnight's time. Up next is The Punk Show. So for me, Peter Carney, until then, take care.
Community radio for North East Dublin, 90.3. Near FM.